The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and welcome along to The Home Show. This is Sinead Ryan, your host, coming up this week. Would you grow veg in your front garden for all the neighbours to see? Well, for a community in Cabra in Dublin City, that's exactly why they're community heroes. Top Danish designer Morten Jorgsen on why Scandi design can be so timeless. Former Home of the Year judge Sarah Cosgrove on why we get it so wrong with our kitchen design. And Arlene McIntyre on the floors that work best with underfloor heating. If you'd like to get involved in our podcast, well, you're welcome to contact us at any time during the week. Our email is thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Instagram and on X, and I know lots of listeners try to get in touch with me there. Always delighted to hear from you. Now, nothing creates more interest or conflict in a home rebuild than getting the kitchen put in, with so much choice available on materials, styles, appliances, lighting, islands. It can seem like an impossible series of choices to make. But here, to ease us into it, is interior designer and former Home of the Year judge, Sarah Cosgrove. You're very welcome back to the Home Show.
I know. Thank you for having me, Sinead.
Now, I think, look, the bigger the spaces that we are now living in, right? The big boxes that we are now, you know, putting in our downstairs, the more kitchen options there seem to be. And it's like long gone from the place where we just used to cook our meals.
Yeah.
It's the whole focus of the house, isn't it?
It's everything. Yeah. And I mean, just to put it out there, I'm sort of anti the big box, if I'm honest. I think it actually doesn't really suit how we live. So I'm always encouraging small, you know, you want to have a nice, decent sized space, but I always think break things up, have a pantry, have smaller rooms, have a little breakout rooms. If you are at the planning stage, sometimes bigger is not better. And I think when it comes to the kitchen, that is often the case. I think there is definitely, we've got huge international inspiration now coming at us through social media, Pinterest, etc. And we're often seeing kind of scales of homes that don't always apply. We're getting inspired by that. And then when we actually try and execute it in our own kitchens, it's not always working. So I think getting scale right in a room and in a kitchen in particular is really important. And I kind of firmly believe not always, more space doesn't always make better kitchens or better design. So I think it's actually really important when doing your kitchen is to think about how you live rather than what the space is and what maybe you're seeing elsewhere.
Yeah, it's the function over form thing, isn't it, really?
Yes.
You know, and anytime we talk to chefs, you know, people who cook professionally, they're like, give me a small kitchen in a triangle any day of the week, you know.
Yeah, stainless steel countertops, everything, you're lined up like a brigade. Yeah. It works smoothly. No, and I do think that that's, there's a lot to be said for that. And I also think it's whatever about the cooking, there's also the cleaning element. And we can often see kind of traffic jams or, you know, spaces that get overuse in terms of cleaning the dishwasher, the oven, the fridge. If you don't space those in a clever way, you can often create these kind of hot spots within a kitchen where really only one person can function well. And I think, so it's really important to do the planning, to think about how you live, because not everyone cooks. And I know a lot of families rely very heavily on an appliance, which is often an air fryer. But now we're
seeing... Doesn't mean they don't want the big kitchen with all the cabinets and all the stuff.
No, they don't. But like what I think now, and we'll talk about appliances, but now I think a lot of appliances are realising they have to be more than one thing. So you're getting the air fryers going into, say, an oven function, which is great because that's one less appliance on your counter space. And I think counter space is a real asset.
Yeah,
you know?
It is, because you need space not only just to put stuff, but also to chop and
prep
and have your bowls and all, you know, and divvy out all your bits. When it comes to, and I don't know where you sit on the island, right? It just, I don't think there's a choice anymore. I think, you know, it's nearly an obligation to have an island stuck in the middle of the space. But there's always that dilemma. Do you put the hob there or do you put the sink there? Or what do you leave it for? And is there a right way to do that? And where should everything go?
I'm a real traditionalist in terms of I have everything on, I would prefer to have my island clear of appliances and have them on the back run.
Really?
Or the rear run, you know, depending on what your layout is. My preference is if you can have a clear island, have it as a clear island, have it as a prep space, have it as a social space, have it as, you know, somewhere to do the homework or whatever.
Okay, so put up your high stools and just leave it as a slab of granite.
So you've one, you know, part high for your prep and lower that's more like a dining table. Like, it just depends on the space that you have. So I'm a traditionalist. Now, I design plenty of kitchens where we have one or the t'other on the island. Mm. I think one of the things you've got to realise is if you have a sink or a hob, you're going to have clutter around it. I'm personally, I like to clean surfaces down. I like to have, I'm kind of an ordered person. So things that I would always say is if you're going to have a hob or a sink on an island, maybe design in a trough or really clever kind of drawer storage either side of your oils, your peppers, your salts. You know, it's
right.
To plan. It's and I think that's the thing. It's you want the aesthetic to look good, but actually it won't look good no matter how you design it if it's not designed cleverly.
Yeah. And if you're constantly turning around and bringing a boiling pot over to a different part of the kitchen, 100%. You know, that's the kind of thing that you're trying to avoid, really.
But until
you're in it, it can be hard to know, oh, crikey, I got this wrong now. I'm
going
to put this in the wrong
place. Some people are super social and they love cooking. They love the theatre cooking. They want to be able to face out. They want someone to be able to sit on the end of an island with a glass of wine and chat away to them. They don't want to be facing away from the family or facing away from...
They're like doing their cooking demo while everybody's
sitting. Literally, and they love that. You know, and for certain people, that actually makes a lot of sense. But you're right. I mean, as I said, traditionally, I think if you're the space, I would go on the back run, keep my island clear. And I also think it's just to be mindful of the scale of the island.
Okay. Yeah. Now, one of the appliances that is a newbie, I think, in the market, and I only experienced it recently. I was down at an Airbnb over Easter down the west, and it was lovely. And they had the hob, say, on the counter, but there was no hood over it. So I have a huge big hood over mine at home. I can't do anything about it. But nowadays they have these hobs, which have the suck down the steam from the vent. And they have really revolutionized space and the illusion of space, actually.
No, I'm the biggest convert. I mean, I actually don't know. I think we might have put in one extract in the last, but like I would definitely be heavily angling, if the space allows it, for the integrated hob, so, or the integrated vent. So you are definitely, if you don't need that vent, I would just lose it, you know. And even we're seeing, you know, proper chefs, people who really genuinely proper cooks, they've completely embraced it.
Yeah, it's hard to understand it until you see it in action, because you're thinking, how does that work? Where does the smoke go? But there is literally no smoke. It just gets sucked down into the cooking area.
No, and you know, we're on version 3, 4, 5. So like they came around maybe, I was probably coming on 10 years ago now, the first models would have been released. So you're 10 years into the technology. We have people who love cooking fish, fry ups, all of that. And they would have been really nervous, smells going throughout the home, et cetera, That's not happening.
Really?
Okay. No, it's really amazing. And even with the induction, you've got so many different options in terms of control. There's the induction element and there's the integrated vent element.
Yeah.
And they are really super user-friendly.
Yeah, made a big difference.
And in terms of design, and especially, say, in apartments or smaller spaces, you know, being able to lose that vent really actually opens up how you can design your kitchen.
Because they're ugly. I mean, even the nice big copper pan ones, like they're ugly.
No,
and they're
just building them in and you're losing storage.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, you're a NEF ambassador, so you're across all of the appliances and everything like that. One of the innovations, apart from that hood being gone and that sucky air thing, is the ovens we see. Now, you see them on Bake Off, if you watch the Great British Bake Off, which everybody seems obsessed with it. Is that what it's called?
It's hide and slide.
It's like you open the oven door and it slides in underneath. Yeah. Now, I'd be thinking, gee, all the air going out of my kitchen and the cost of it. But actually, there's some kind of magic heat retention yoke which avoids that I don't understand. Science of which I do not understand.
Yeah.
But people love that idea, don't they? The novelty of it.
Well, it's the novelty, but it also comes back to one of my earlier points, just in terms of avoiding hotspots in the kitchen, actually usability of space.
Yeah.
The hide and slide is really effective. It also is really much easier to get things in and out. And especially if you're doing casseroles, larger dishes where you've got a heavy thing.
And you're not hovering over
exactly,
the open door. All right.
Lean across.
Now, listen, I know you're not a fan of the row of pendant lights. Are you on a mission?
No, I'm not. I'm actually sorry. It's everything in its space. You know, there's a right thing and there's the wrong thing. It's factor everything. You want to design for space. And to be honest, the row of pendants can work. I do it myself. I, in the right place, it does work. But I think what you've got to be doing, it's got to be so much more. You need to have task light as well as decorative light. Like, I'm such a champion for layers of light.
Mm.
So if you're relying on just those pendants to give you that task light, it often doesn't provide enough. And you end up creating a dark patch within the kitchen.
Right.
So, or you have to go blast up the bulb wattage. So it's that real blue, cold, heavy light that I hate. So it's kind of a case of, it's more, you've got to think when you're looking at lighting is to design in layers of light.
Yeah.
So the pendants have a place, but they shouldn't be the only option.
I read that you wrote somewhere that, you know, a line of pendants is not a lighting plan. But for many people, that's the first thing they want.
Well, this
kitchen.
Is it. Well, it's to balance it all out.
Yeah. And Camille, where do you stand on breaking up spaces? So you said, okay, you're not a big fan of the big box kitchens, but lots of people love them and they want the big window at the back, blame Dermot Bannon, blah, 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 whatever. In terms of breaking up that space, the island sometimes can do that. But would you be a fan of kind of dividers and different flooring surfaces just to give the eye something to focus on in, you know, this is a seating area, this is a cooking area, this is an eating area?
Well, we would often have people or clients who would like to have, like, say, timber floor throughout. But timber floor in a kind of a wet space, i.e. adjacent to a sink, is a really bad idea. It will get trashed. Even runners and rugs covering it, it's not going to hold up in that space. Now, some people like the rough and ready look, but if you want to maintain it, so we often prescribe a thing called a shuffle zone. So we would do a tiled area around the sink. So if you've got an island, it can often be kind of zoned really nicely. We call it a shuffle zone. So it's actually where you're spending most time in the kitchen, around the oven, around the sink.
High wear
area. Yeah. So you just do a little tile section. It works really well. It's easy to clean. And if you have any spillages or whatever, it mops it up. And then you get to have your lovely kind of timber floor or laminate floor elsewhere.
Great.
I think from a principle, if you've got a large space, you want to kind of keep the floor as consistent as possible. But I do think a shuffle zone, if you want to timber or a softer material on your floor, a shuffle zone.
That's a good way of doing it. All right. Okay. Well, listen, thanks a million for all of that. Great tips as always there. Do you miss the home of the year, do you?
I miss you.
I know.
Devastated.
He was such an innovator and just a presence on all our screens. So certainly.
So I miss you a lot.
All right. Well, listen, onwards and upwards with you, Sarah. Where can people find you?
Well, I'm at sarahcosgrove.com.
Great. Okay. Yeah. And of course, you can go to homeofinnovation.ie or nef-home.com and you'll find all the bits and bobs about those magic hobsuckers. Call them. I'm sure they have a nicer
That's
name
a
for
word.
Them than that. That's mine. All right, Sarah Cogdrew. Yep. Thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, Scandi Design is lauded as the epitome of understated class, minimalism and clean lines. My next guest, Danish designer Morten Georgsen, is in Ireland for the launch of the new Beau Concept store in Navan. Morten, you're very welcome to the Home Show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Now, what is the secret to Scandinavian design for something that we have just adopted and we love? And we love maybe the cleanness of it, the pale colours, the neutrals that go with it, and the beautiful manufacture process. But for you, what does it mean?
You know, I try to go back in a bit in history on that one, because in the late 50s, beginning of the 60s, we had some of the best designers, architects in the world. And you call it Scandinavian design, you know. And the reason it's called Scandinavian design, that was actually because when Finn Juhl, who was the one doing furniture for the United Nations building in New York, and Widner, he made what they called the chair in United States. When Kennedy was on the TV with Nixon for the presidency, they were sitting in the chair made by Wehner, one of the Danish architects.
Right, interesting.
But the Americans, they had no idea at that time what Denmark was, you know, because there are not that many Danish people that are Irish people in the United States. So they call it Scandinavia. But we think that Danish design is quite different from Scandinavian design.
Oh, you're carving it out. You're exactly, separating yourself from the Swedes there, are you? Okay.
So what that means is that we have this history of design going back to these famous architects and designers at that time. And the authenticity in it, I think that is what people like. I always say, you know, you can maybe, what is the shortest line between two points?
That's a straight one, isn't it?
That's a straight one. What is the shortest line between a function and aesthetics? That's crafted minimalism. And that is what we are going for always. And it's a bit like when you're saying, okay, I didn't have time to make this letter shorter.
Yeah.
Right? It's the same thing with furniture. I didn't have time to make this essential, you know, just get into the core of it. So you put a lot of ornaments on it, and that's easier than go into the core of a design.
Yeah.
And that's what we're achieving with Danish design.
Because there's no hiding then.
There's no hiding.
Every bit of it has
to
be perfect.
You're absolutely right.
Okay.
That's the whole idea about it. And I'm pretty sure that is what people really appreciate today, that there's no hiding in it. But at the same time, I have to say we are going a lot with, when we're talking about function, people think, okay, that is something mechanical. No, it's also the seating, it's the comfort, it's everything that's optimized.
Yeah. Yeah, because that kind of function and form thing in architecture, which we see with buildings and, you know, it's drilled into architects that, you know, form follows function. But it seems to me that in that style of design, it is just so. It has to be, because you've so little to work with. There's so little frippery or extras kind of to add on.
Yeah, yeah. It's true, but what we do then is also to, because it has longevity, not only in the functions that you do today, but also in the craftsmanship, so it lasts for a long, long time. Mm. And because the design is so simple or minimalistic, you could say it will last forever. And especially today when we're talking about sustainability and all that, it is more important than ever.
Yeah, and of course then, and I mean this in a good way, it doesn't have to be fashionable if that's
exactly,
the case.
Exactly. And that is why you said that with the colors, and that is absolutely true. But sometimes, you know, people, when they talk about Danish or Scandinavian design, they think of something that's absolutely straight and lean and all that. Mm. No. We have also been working a lot with organic designs. If you take Finjul that I mentioned before, he was one of the first that really was exploiting wood and what it could do, you know, to be organic as well.
Yeah, because when we think of that, the Bauhaus movement, we're thinking of those curved woods and that curved design, which was, it's really hard to do, isn't it? Like it's technically quite difficult.
Yeah, it is. And you know, a lot of the ideas actually come from the Bauhaus design in Danish design. But what the Danish designers and what we, you know, that comes after, we have been able to do, that is to take it off something that look industrialized. Although it is made in factories, it is not appearing like something that's industrialized. And that was, Bauhaus was too industrialized for a lot of people. But the idea about making it simple and making it something for the people, that was the idea behind Bauhaus, right? To make furniture for the people.
Yeah.
But the Germans never understood it. The Danes, they took it to a different level where we put the wood into it and made it much more human.
And soft, and softened
soft.
It and lightened it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think humanizing is the best word. We humanized the Bauhaus.
Yeah, because people have to live with this furniture and live in it and have it around. It's not just over in the corner there. Now, you mentioned there the sustainability element, and of course, that is brought into fabrics, textiles,
everything,
the linens, the cottons. Yeah. How important is that when you are treating this furniture as an aesthetic as a whole, Morten?
Of course, we're taking into account in everything we're doing today, and we're trying to minimalize not only in the word that we're saying about furniture, but also the amount of material that we are using. And I think that is something that actually is very good in Danish design as well, that it is minimalized, so you don't use extra things to achieve what you really want to do. Mm. If I look at some of the competitors from other countries, I don't want to name the countries.
We won't then.
but they are adding way too much, from my opinion, to achieve something, because they are not going to the core of what they want to achieve. Because, as I said before, it's easier just to add something.
Yeah, it's harder to do that. Now, one of the things which does feature heavily when you look at Danish design is biophilia, including plantings, greenery. And it strikes me that the reason for that, it's a lesson we can learn in Ireland, is in the Northern Hemisphere, it can be dark. It can get dark earlier. There isn't much light. We have to try and find our greenery where we can get it. And I love that idea of the juxtaposition, the placement of big potted plants indoors beside this minimalist furniture. How do you incorporate that? Or is that important?
Yes, of course it's important, and it has always been important for Danes, I think. I remember, when I grew up in my home, we had plants all over. So together with the classic kind of Danish furniture. At that time, when they got married in Denmark, the first thing they did was that they bought one piece of furniture, right? And you were thinking, that is stupid to put so much money into it. But I just inherited from my aunt a chair, an ox chair, that she bought, 60 years ago. Mm. And that shows the longevity also of that. But I agree with you that plants and the nature of the wood, and also now with Bokanser, we are working a lot with another material called ceramics, mm-hmm. which is very interesting also, because it is actually from clay, that you press clay together, right? And it's like a porcelain surface, and it's very durable. That is also a way to minimize material, because it's only 3 millimeter thick or 5 millimeter thick.
Yeah,
so we are doing a lot to minimize things in general, again, for the longevity and sustainability of things.
Yeah, and then what you end up with then is, because all these things exist in nature together, they look right together in a room. Okay, so talk to me a little bit about this Bow concept, the collaboration that you have with them. There's a few stores in Dublin. I was up in, actually, as it happens, up in the new one in Navan. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah,
and
so
do you know, even the way it's laid out, there's a bit
of... That's why, I'm looking forward to going there.
You walk in, you go, if only. What is it about their sense of style? I immediately think of curves and fabric when I think of Bow Concept.
I've been working with them almost for 30 years now, with Bow Concept, and I was a part of the transition from being a factory into being a retailer, which they are today. And before that, I was with Bang & Olufsen. So I have this kind
of... All right, audio. And
I actually had some offers to go to Japan to work in Japan, but at that time it was boxes, boxes, boxes. And I thought that the Bow Concept was closer to Bang & Olufsen was closer to something for the home than an electronic.
Yeah.
So that is why I started working with furniture, and the whole setup of Bow Concept I think what people write about it is that it's authentic. If you come in there and you see the whole, how the colors are put together, how the products, the shapes and everything is put together, it's so authentic.
Mm.
There's nothing that stands out there in the room screaming, here I am. And this is exactly what we want to achieve. We want to have that subtle, exclusive look.
That was Danish designer Morten Georgsen. Thanks for coming into the home show. And you can check out all of the stores now in Dublin and now in Navan. Scott Brian founded Community Roots when he saw the amount of underused public and private spaces in his neighbourhood of Cabra in Dublin. But he set about transforming them through his organisation and ended up winning one of four AXA Community Heroes. And he joins me now in studio. You're very welcome to the home show, Scott. Tell us a little bit about how this got started. This is effectively a gardening project, but you're not a gardener.
Yeah, so Community Roots is essentially a community development nonprofit, bringing people together from all walks of life, but living in the same community through food, growing, sharing and preparing food. Soil Mates is our flagship program. It's Ireland's first structured garden share scheme where we connect garden owners with budding growers to grow food in community. During the pandemic, when everyone else seemed to be taking up sea swimming, I started growing a bit of food. And I've been involved in various community projects over the years. And doing that activity, not only did it get me out of my head, into my community, save a few quid in the weekly shop, but it unlocked this latent superpower in my head where all I could see around me, even in a densely populated neighbourhood like Cabra, is space. So much underused space that could be used to tackle many of the pervasive social ills in our communities. And so together with my friend and neighbour, Katrina Kenny, we set up a community scheme. We got a small grant. And the idea was to set up a post-pandemic befriending service where we'd pair older people living on their own, maybe experiencing loneliness, that had gardens with younger people living around the corner. But it just snowballed. It kind of captured a zeitgeist. And we had so many people from different backgrounds asking to be part of it. And to be honest with you, I remember going to a Friends of the Elderly held a lunch and learn event for me. And I was going in, probably a bit patronising with hindsight, with the idea that, you know, you're feeling lonely and we'll set you up with a budding grower to grow food with you. And, you know, the older people saying, you know, I'm grand, you know, but I'd like to be part of this, but, you know, I'm not lonely. I'd like to go to someone's house. I grew food when I was younger and I could go to a young family's home and show them. So we realised it had so much more potential, and we set it up as formalised as a non-profit. So
do you have people then who have kind of carved out a piece of their garden and then their neighbour comes in and just potters around in it of a day and they're watching them from the front window?
So will I describe the process first to you very briefly? We make a pairing based on proximity. So people will sign up sometimes at an in-person information event or on our website. And we will pair them based on proximity. And we will arrange for them to meet with someone from Community Roots for a cup of coffee, and they can get a sense of the person. And if they're happy to proceed, which they invariably always are, we have a safeguarding process that we'll follow, guard vetting where required.
Okay.
And then we will set them up with a 2 square metre raised bed, which is built by the local men's shed in whatever community we're established ourselves in. We have a partnership with GIY, who you mentioned, and we provide them with a GIY grow box and access to a companion online course. And the raised bed is 2 square metres. So it's not a huge amount of space, but it's a boundary. So when a stranger is coming in, essentially, into someone's garden, this is their...
That's the limit of their...
They're not digging up a lawn with potatoes and not coming back.
Sure.
So it establishes a rapport. And often what happens is then the gardener will say, you know what, why don't you use all of that area as well?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it can be really, really wonderful. We have 2 newcomers to Ireland growing food in a nursing home. The director of nursing there in Ashbourne told me recently that some of the residents didn't go outside until this project happened, and those two people were growing food there, and they come out now to check on it.
Yeah.
We have people experiencing homelessness growing food in a home for adults with special needs. We have lots of intergenerational type pairings.
So is this like what we would have known as an allotment kind of arrangement?
No, it's much smaller. You could say it's like a dispersed community garden, maybe. Basically, what we do is it's like matchmaking, but without the romance. Someday, maybe some of our matches, there may be romance, but...
Carrots for parsnips.
Maybe, yeah, a bit of a barter arrangement there. But essentially, yeah, we will find, based on proximity, we will find a garden owner, has underused space. It might be an older person. It could be business. It could be a young family. Any type of person that happens to have a garden space that they're not using. And we will pair them with a gardenless budding grower, again, it could be someone living in an apartment or a bedsit or someone who doesn't have access to their own space, and they will come there to grow food, often together, or sometimes it's just the gardener facilitating it and the gardener might get the spoils of a few spuds or salads. And really, the magic is it's the food. People are interested in the fundamental skill, but they come for the food, but often stay for the connection. So it's about bringing people together that may not meet ordinarily, but they're living very close together. And so connecting people and, you know, making magic happen.
I suppose it doesn't occur to us because we have such an attachment to our gardens front and back. And we convert them into lawns and we plant flowers and maybe have a few herbs in a pot. But I know when you go to somewhere like Asia or Japan, like every square inch is being used for food production.
Yeah.
And lots of places are completely self-sufficient homes.
Yeah.
Is it weird that we just don't do that culturally?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, if you think about how much of our food we import, we're very vulnerable in a climate crisis to supply chain shocks. So first and foremost, there's, as I said, 37% of Greater Dublin alone is garden space. There's huge potential there to make communities that bit more resilient. But it's not just resilience, a resilience piece in terms of supply chains and food. It's about well-being as well. So that space has so much potential to do lots for communities, as well as providing it's not just a performative amount of food. It's actually, you could actually grow a significant amount of food for a community where you're using space that's not used.
We've had Mick Kelly of GIY in Waterford on the show many, many times, and that was his basis. He used to work in IT. And like that, he was shopping one day, came across a garlic that had come from China or something. He said, that's ridiculous. And he tried to grow it. And now he has this multi-million euro enterprise. You express this as something that was hidden inside you, you know, it was kind of waiting to be unleashed. But how did you get other people involved in it? Did you find it difficult or did they come kind of flocking?
Well, when you were asking me there about how I regard that, all that space and the potential, I was thinking about it at the beginning as thinking of John B. Keynes, the field, you know, and the Bull McKay mentality. Mm-hmm. No one's going to share their bit of space, but people are incredibly open-minded. And in a world that seems to be going to pot, that's being on the ground and connecting with all of that very positive spirit is really a salve for the soul, you know.
Is it like that control the controllables? You know, here's something I can actually do. I can't fix oil prices. I can't worry too much about Trump.
Exactly. And then it's the ripple effect, because critical mass, you know, as more and more people, like, just think about it on a street where one person would sign up to our scheme and we'll install a raised bed and give them all the kit to get started. And it's invariably in a front garden and there's a little sign on it saying growing food, sharing gardens. And then the neighbour up the road is then asking, oh, that looks interesting, I want to be part of it. And so that's kind of the ripple effect in action.
Then you have the FOMO from the neighbours who planted tulips and they're like, oh, I'm not part of that. So that really then ended up as a community project wider than the growing of food for you. The AXA Community Heroes thing then came along, and that gives awards and money, real money, across a range of areas like mental health and education. But you won the community award. How did that come about?
Well, I got a call from AXA a couple of weeks ago, and I think I was shell-shocked. You know, I thought I was renewing my insurance. Did I have insurance with AXA? But it turns out my wife nominated me, and I won in the sustainability category. So they give you €20,000 for your organisation, which is absolutely massive as a volunteer-led organisation that will enable us to do so much more. Bring our scheme to more communities, because there's a lot of demand there. Capacity is not keeping a pace with demand. But also, when you're doing something like this on the ground, your head's down and you're firefighting, I guess. So with something like this, it gives you a moment to reflect and realize that, you know, what you're doing is working and it's having an impact. And so it's really I'm really grateful for it, and it's really, it will be transformative for us as well.
And in terms of what you would say to other people who want to look at something like this, I mean, Cabra is quite a built-up area. It's an urban, an old urban residential area in Dublin City. And if you can do it, I suppose anywhere can. What would you recommend to people who would like to get started along something like this?
Well, there's two things I would say. Firstly, we're established across Dublin, and we're currently expanding in Dublin 8, in Burren, County Offaly, and starting in Finglas, Dublin 11. So if anyone wanted to get involved from any of those areas, whether they're a garden owner or a budding grower, they can get in touch on communityroots.ie. If you're looking at starting your own community scheme, or however small or big, all I'd say is don't wait till it's perfect or till you feel it's ready. Just do it, and you will evolve with it. And that is probably the biggest, best piece of advice I'd give, because too often you can procrastinate around things you'd love to do, and invariably then it doesn't get done because you're never, if you wait till it's ready, it's never ready.
Isn't that a good life lesson? Because we can sometimes, I think social media has a bit to play here for good and ill, because you can look at beautiful gardens, raised beds, you know, colour trend, all this, you know, everything is perfect. Mm. And you think, well, until I can do that, I can't do anything. But actually, what do you need? A pot and a soil and a seed.
Yeah, and don't forget the people. It's very important. A few exactly. Willing neighbours.
Well, listen, it's a fantastic project. Congratulations on it. It sounds like a lot of work, but very satisfying.
I'm following my goosebumps, so it's fine.
Right, that's a good way to look at it. All right. Scott Bryan of Community Roots, and you can find more about that project on communityroots.ie.
The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, we've spoken a lot on the show in the past about retrofitting and the grants available for things like heat pumps and insulation, but many homes also benefit from underfloor heating, which can be installed at the same time, and it maximises the output from the heat. But deciding what flooring goes on top can be very tricky, and it must be able to conduct the heat from underneath. Well, here to explain what's involved and what's best for that is one of our favourite home show designers, Arlene McIntyre from Ventura Design. Arlene, you're very welcome along to the show. Now, listen, it's very common to refit flooring on this way or to decide what you need, but what options are available first? Tiling seems to be the most obvious one.
Yes, definitely tiling is really popular, but so is timber. But if we were to first talk about tiling options, we're finding a really strong movement towards porcelain tiles, which are, of course, man-made. They're very durable. They're very sexy. They come in beautiful, large profile, you know, formats. They are great for high traffic areas. They're really durable, and they're definitely compatible with underfloor heating.
Porcelain tiles are stunning, and they're so beautiful to look at. But I must say, my first thought is the cleaning and keeping them nice and shiny. Can that be a problem?
No, not at all. Not at all. There's so much choice on the market. We work a lot with a brand called Porcelain Nosa, and they have a really wide range of tones to choose from. So you can go for, rather than like a white porcelain tile or even a cream, you can go for one that's slightly mottled. That actually looks like stone. So you wouldn't believe how much you can actually bury into a tile like this. It can disguise a lot of dirt, and it is very hard wearing.
Mm. And people love the underfloor kind of heating and the feeling of it when they're walking around, because on these tiles, these are the people now who make you take off your shoes at the door. I'm not one of them. I'm in the other camp. But you can get that feeling of warmth. And it's important, Arlene, isn't it, with whatever flooring you're putting down with underfloor heating, that process is allowed to happen.
Oh, for sure. But they are like the products that are available on the market are so futuristic, and they are all with, you know, underfloor heating in mind. So this is not something that's a new consideration. Mm. What's on offer is very much on alignment with that. And you'll find great options in most of the, you know, leading brand stores.
Now, what about ceramics? Because people do traditionally like a ceramic tile, and indeed stone. How do both of those materials work with underfloor heating?
Well, both are good. It also depends on the thickness. But if I were to be totally honest with you, I think the market primarily is moving towards the porcelain, the ceramic, because of their durability. They don't require the same, you know, care that a natural stone would require. Although natural stone is very unique and it's beautiful and it's a slab that's unique to you and your home, I actually would far more prefer to reach for a porcelain for so many reasons. And it's not necessarily because it's better in price. It's just that it's more durable.
Now, I know that the trend at the moment is for these very, very large porcelain tiles. I mean, you're looking up to like huge slab formats. Does that work in a kitchen that might be smaller as well? Or are you better going for a smaller tile in that sense?
That's a great question. I would go larger because the larger the tile, the larger the floor space looks. The smaller the tile, the smaller the floor space looks. So going larger is always more important for me. And of course, you can get grouts in so many different tones as well. So you don't see grout lines. You just see this seamless, large tile finish in your kitchen. It's really luxurious. I'd highly recommend it.
Okay, so it's like an optical illusion. Your eye is drawn to the expanse of space rather than the joints. Yeah. Okay. Now, listen, Arlene, people still love their timber. They love their wooden floors. Is it possible to make that work with underfloor heating? Or do you have a warping issue there?
No, not at all. Definitely, I would veer away from solid woods. And I'm not really working myself with solid woods on any of our projects. But engineered flooring is the way to go. And there, again, is so much on the market. I'm a real lover of prime grade flooring, which really is beautiful. It's, again, very compatible with underfloor heating. It's all down to the thickness of the floor. And, of course, it is definitely compatible with underfloor heating. You will have a slight reduction in the heat flow that comes through, but it will hold the heat. And by no means, like, is it that it's going to not give you heat. You will still get a good level of heat through the timber floor, as you would with the tile.
Okay. And does that mean then the carpet, and look, you know, I know the whole point is that you don't need your carpet now because the heat is coming up from underneath. But people do like rugs and mats and runners and carpeting bits of their downstairs. So can that work in any way, or is it just a waste?
Well, carpet can traditionally and underlay kind of, reduce heat outputs very slightly, but like so will a, engineered floor and so will a tile. So I wouldn't let any of these options kind of get in the way of making these decisions. But we have a lot of people that combine the timber floor with a large area rug, or, you know, if they're all tiled, if they're going for a fully tiled option, they'll combine that with a rug layer just to have that layer of luxury in the room.
Now, when would you advise people to get thinking about the flooring? I mean, if they're in the middle of a big retrofit project and we know how expensive they can be, grants aside, it's a big chunk of change. So people need to consider their flooring options when the underfloors, when all those pipes are going in underneath early on, don't they really?
Oh, absolutely. That's another very good question. Yes. The sooner you start planning your flooring options, the better. I mean, that is actually something we spend a lot of time on. Is planning your floors. And some people are really undecided about, should I go timber? Should I go tile? What will look best? What am I going to love in 10 years? And I think, really, if you keep it neutral, you'll never grow tired of it. And if you're really undecided and you'd like a combination of the two, we're currently doing a lot of timber borders in hallways with the tile recessed into a timber border. And that is a gorgeous combination.
Oh, right.
You can play with flooring.
So how does that work then? So it looks like you've got the skirting board and the flooring is disappearing underneath it. Is that it?
Yeah, we have a timber border line which runs under the skirting. And then we drop the tile into the center line of that. And it's a really gorgeous look. It's something we're doing quite a lot and it creates a lovely finish. And then that can be naturally running then through into, for example, your living room off the hallway. Could then be all timber. But you've got your high traffic area in a tile surrounded by that border of warmth.
Yes. And then, you can break up the different areas even within a large room with the different types of flooring, and you don't even need dividers or anything anymore because they're all pretty seamless, aren't they? They're very modern products.
They are very modern products. And, you know, there are really great sales out there. So back to your question about price. Just keep an eye on sales.
Yeah.
And yeah, you'll get great deals out there.
All right. Well, listen, fantastic advice as always, Arlene. And thanks a million for all of that. And you can find Arlene and all that she does on Ventura Design on Instagram and indeed in the shops that she has. All right, Arlene, thanks a million for that. And that's it. That's all we have this week on the Home Show Pod. Hope you enjoyed our different topics. But if there's a topic you'd like us to cover or a guest you'd like us to have on, something you read, something you're thinking about in design terms, give us a call, give us a shout. You can find us on email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com and me on X and on Instagram at SineadRyan100. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound, and we will do it all again next time. And don't forget to like and subscribe The Home Show Pod, and you won't miss an episode. See you next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.